My task today is to show you something. And the something that I'm going to show you, we run face to face into it in the book of Colossians. And that book is pretty much, it's not really a book in that sense. It's a letter that's written by one of the first century leaders in the church. It's a gentleman by the name of Paul. And the big question that we are aiming at answering as we study the letter that Paul wrote is, what does it mean to follow Jesus? So in essence, in light of what Jesus has done, in light of Jesus' finished work, what does that mean for us? What are the implications? What are we supposed to do with our lives? And so today, if you want to track along with me, you got your Bible with you, you got your phone with you, or your iPad, or whatever you're toting with you, we'll be in chapter 1 of the letter that we call Colossians. We'll start in verse 15. We'll work up to verse 20, and that's where we'll be hanging out today. But before we get started, there's a big idea that I'd like for you to try to apply as we study the Bible today. And then in addition to that, try to apply it to your personal Bible study as well. When you crack the spine on God's Word, God is showing you something that's not, it's not a good idea. It's not a quasi-beneficial idea. It's the absolute truth. And the Bible tells us that our minds, because the fact that they're ravaged by sin, because we don't naturally come up with good ideas, our minds are supposed to be transformed by the truth. I am convinced that the truth that God delivers in the Bible is the truth that is supposed to transform the way that we think, the way that we live, the way that we love, the way that we do absolutely everything that we engage in. And these five verses that we're going to study today, I want you to think of those as the hinges. They're the hinges of this letter in particular, meaning that everything that Paul has said leading up to this point and everything that he's going to say after this point make absolutely no sense if we divorce ourselves from these five verses. And I'll take it even one step further and argue that Christianity itself, if you remove this aspect of Christianity, there's no such thing as Christianity if we don't apply these five verses to how we absolutely understand and engage in what we call Christian living or Christianity or whatever you want to call it. These verses are the hinges of this letter, not because they're insightful or because they're pointed in their description of who they describe, but they're the hinges because they point to someone upon which everything relies. And that someone, you're asking, is Jesus. These five verses are about Jesus. They are a vivid, accurate, perfect picture of the resurrected Jesus that we so easily say we want to follow. And so one way to understand the person and work of Jesus is the way that a great preacher by the name of Charles Haddon Spurgeon described him. And what he says about Jesus is that Jesus is the central fact of the world's history. Everything either is looking back at Jesus or looking forward to Jesus. All of the lines of history converge on Jesus, and all of the great purposes of God find their absolute and utter culmination in Jesus. So this morning, my goal was to give you two really big, high-level ideas that I believe Paul explicitly states in this text. And as we study this text, you're going to see that Paul, he's not giving us a list of things to do. Instead, he's revealing the identity of the Jesus that we say we follow. So we're in verse 15. We're going to go ahead and get started. And what we read there is, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for everything was created by him in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and by him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile everything to himself by making peace through the blood of his cross, whether things on earth or things in heaven. So for me, when I approach a text like this, I like to ask myself some simple questions that might drive the direction that I'll take when I'm studying this text. And the question that I ask myself around these five verses is, what in the world motivated Paul to write these specific verses, to give this specific description of Jesus to these people, after when we read in the opener of this letter that Paul's already saying, these guys they believe in Jesus. So my mind leads me to believe if they already believe in Jesus, well, then they must know something about him. They must know something about what he's done and what he's capable of doing. But in addition to that, I'd like to give you some of the insights that I found as I studied the Colossian church. The church, as far as where it's at on a trajectory of growth, it's extremely young. And like all of the other churches at that time, it's young because they're just a few decades removed from actually the Jesus, the live rendering of God, walking the earth, living a perfect life, dying an atoning death, and then being raised back to life. So they're not that far removed from the time when Jesus was actually alive. And as far as their cultural makeup, these are not Jewish people. Most of them are what we would call Gentiles. So in other words, they didn't grow up going to the synagogue. They haven't spent time studying under a rabbi. And like some of us, we could actually consider them unchurched. If I'm thinking of myself in particular, I would consider myself unchurched. I grew up loosely affiliated to a church. I had loose ideas about what church was, what Bible study was, what it meant to go to church. So these people, in a lot of ways, they're unchurched. Their experience with church is being built as the days go by in the church at Colossae, where they call home. So like us, despite their lack of experience with Jesus, with God, with God's word, they've seen proverbial images of God. They've seen proverbial images of Jesus in the way that people talk about God, in the way that people describe Jesus' work, in the way that people interact with each other as a result of Jesus' work in their lives. And from these pictures, the Colossian church has, what they've done is they've formed ideas, they've drawn conclusions, and they've established expectations with regards to who God is and what God's capable of doing. But the catch here is that there's a ton that they have yet to figure out when it comes to who God really is and who Jesus really is. And as a result of the belief system that they're being called out of, one that relied heavily on calling on angels or superpowers or whatever you want to call them, the spiritual realm, to combat their day-to-day trials, their day-to-day struggles, their perceptions of things that were evil, they called on spirits to handle that at that end of their lives. And as a result of that, the risk that they ran, which is a lot like the risk that I ran coming from an unchurched camp, and it's a lot like the risk that all of us run when we come up with ideas about God on our own, is we take this Jesus and we add him to the melting pot of spiritual ideas that we have. And we might think of him as like this God that's going to come in and he'll round us out a little bit, he'll enhance how we're living, he'll make things a little bit better, but he's impotent when it comes to him actively making me different, causing me to think differently about the people in my life, causing me to think differently about my work and my relationships and the things that I'm engaged in. They're a lot like us in that their picture of God is highly influenced in their upbringing, their religious background, the books that they've read, the schools that they went to. And so what they're doing is they're looking at Jesus as another power source, not the ultimate power source. And I'm convinced that if we're honest, absolutely everybody in this room is still working out what does a fully orbed, perfect understanding of the person and work of Jesus mean? What does it mean to follow Jesus at all costs? And if you haven't, like if you're a person and you're sitting in your chair and you're like, I don't really imagine things about Jesus. Well, let me just level with you. You've seen other people imagine things about Jesus then. You've seen renderings or depictions of Jesus that are highly inaccurate. And because of that, we can make the simple deduction that if Paul is giving us a perfect, clear, vivid image of Jesus, he's addressing a mindset that existed in the church filled with Colossian believers, and it exists in the churches that we've called home or the church that we currently attend. And what Paul is saying is, people, do not come up with another idea about Jesus. Allow your ideas about Jesus to be shaped by who he actually is, to be shaped by the truth regarding the risen, resurrected Jesus. And for some of us, what this really means is like We have a Jesus of our agenda, or a Jesus of our interests, or a Jesus of our likes, or a Jesus of our ideas, a Jesus that really likes our upbringing or really hated our upbringing, a Jesus that really likes a particular religious group, or a Jesus that really hates a particular religious group. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I personally have applied the biases that I have, the subconscious thoughts that I have, my patterns of thinking, to formulating ideas about God. And if I've done that with God, what I'm saying is it's highly, highly dangerous. And the reason why I'm doing that with God, though, is simply this. God's hardwired us for a personal interaction with Him. He's hardwired us to know a personal God. The challenge is, because of sin, because of our brokenness, because of our limited understanding, we do not know how to relate to a personal God. And so, in lieu of relating to the personal God that's revealed Himself to us, we come up with ideas and we formulate images of God that we can relate to based on our standards, based on our goals, based on our initiatives, and we easily manipulate and form that image of God into the God that we want it to be. Paul knows how dangerous this can be, and this is what he's addressing in the church at Colossae. So regardless of the scenario, what I believe about people, and you can disagree with me if you think I'm wrong, but what I believe about people is we imagine reality as we want it to be, rather than embracing reality for what it is. So in other words, we come up with ideas that we believe are true, but we don't measure them based on any level of truth. And because this is our tendency, our relationship with Jesus is distorted. It becomes distorted so easily. And if we have a distorted relationship with the God-man Jesus, you can bet your bottom dollar that you're going to have a distorted relationship with everyone else in the room, with your job, with your thoughts about yourself, your thoughts about life in general. And instead of seeing people and valuing people for who they are and how they've been made, you're going to arbitrarily assign value to people and to things, and you're going to pursue things that you find to be valuable, and you're going to reject things that you find to be or that you find lack value. And what I mean there is you're going to gravitate toward things that you like. Things that you dislike, you're going to completely discard. And that's the trend. That's the idea. That's the thought process that I believe Paul is addressing. Because the image of Jesus that had been underhandedly served to the Colossian church was an insufficient Jesus. It was a picture of a Jesus who, he came in, he rescued you from sin, but he had no idea what to do with you after that, so he left you to your own devices, wrestling the day-to-day sin that you continue to encounter in your personal life. He was a God that could only go so far. He was a God that could get you out of the danger that you were in, but he wasn't a God that could absolutely transform the life that you're living today. He was an insufficient Jesus, a start of a new life, but unable or incapable of bringing about absolute transformation in every part of your life. Now, the interesting thing here, and this is actually, to me, this is a very, very hopeful piece of information. What Paul is not saying here is, yeah, so the church at Colossae, it's collapsing. Nobody believes in God anymore. They're not following Jesus. Close the doors. Everybody go home. He's not saying that. Despite their lack of understanding with regard to who Jesus is, despite the fact that at that time they had no New Testament, they hadn't really studied the Old Testament, despite all of their flaws, all of their limitations, and all of their weaknesses, Paul opened this letter proclaiming that they were people that were in Jesus' camp. They themselves were followers of Jesus. And so I'm convinced that Paul, what he's doing in response to what he's seeing and hearing about the Colossian church, is he's responding to our absolute demand to follow a God that we are convinced knows us deeply and loves us beyond our imagination. Paul knows that we cannot serve a God that doesn't know us. And that's why Paul's saying what he's saying. He knows that we need a God that can understand us where we are today, that can love us based on who we are today. And in verse 15, here's what we hear from Paul. He says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. And then you jump up to verse 19, and he goes on to say, "For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him." What Paul is revealing here about Jesus is the first big idea that I want to put before you today. And that idea is simply this, that in Jesus, we see a perfect picture of God. In Jesus, we see a perfect picture of God. It cannot get any more explicit than this. What Paul is literally saying to the church in Colossae is when you look into the eyes of Jesus, you're looking into the eyes of God. Jesus is the icon of God, the accurate, perfect representation of God. The life of Jesus reveals who God is to us, how God desires to interact with us, what God does for us, what God does through us. And in the Jesus that Paul is revealing in verses 15 through 20, I'm just going to give you a little crash course on this picture of Jesus that he's outlining. We meet the Jesus who's responsible for creating and then holding absolutely everything together. This is the entire universe. He's holding absolutely all of it together. He didn't just make it, he's sustaining it, and he's holding it all together. He's making sure that it doesn't utterly fall apart. We meet the Jesus who loves and sustains the church that he's building. We meet the Jesus who was willing to leave the safest, most awesome, most familiar place in the entire universe to enter the unfamiliar, to take risk, to interact with people that didn't really care about who he was. He left safety to take risk. He became completely insufficient so that we could find ultimate sufficiency in him. We meet the Jesus who entered the dysfunction and the chaos of our lives, not to acknowledge it, but to give us significance in him despite the dysfunction and chaos of our lives. We meet the Jesus who is taking everything he made and he is going to systematically make it as it should be. That's people, that's creation, that's the universe itself. So when Paul is spending time describing very vividly and very accurately this picture of Jesus, he is openly addressing our inadequacy in formulating an accurate, vivid picture of Jesus. And if we do just a survey of religious thought or popular thought, what we're going to run into are ideas about Jesus. Some, you know, you got some religious camps that believe that he was an amazing prophet that had wonderful teaching. He was a person that lived a life worth living. He was a man who somehow worked his way to becoming a God. If we look at the attention that Jesus has been given historically, we're going to run into all sorts of depictions of him, some accurate, some inaccurate. And here's what I mean. If we boil it all down, he's been the brunt of more conversations, of more arguments, of more debates. He's been the focus of more art, more music, more thought than any other person who's ever walked the earth. And there are some real interesting ideas about Jesus out there. Some of you watch shows such as South Park and perhaps, and The Simpsons, or maybe you don't. And even if you don't, there are depictions of Jesus. He's been cast in those shows. And on The Simpsons, you know how he's been cast? He's a middle-aged, long-haired, bearded white guy who he's just extremely depressed and he likes hanging out on a swing set. That's a depiction of Jesus that we see in pop culture. We've seen him on t-shirts. We've seen him in stacks and stacks and stacks of books and literature and movies, from The Da Vinci Code to Talladega Nights to you name it. Jesus has been depicted in all realms. And if you're anything like me, even if you're not the one driving these ideas, these physical renderings of Jesus, you have a mental image. There's something that comes to mind when you think of Jesus. And over the course of your life, you've heard stories about him. You've seen church leaders represent him. You've seen people, or you've heard people talk about him. You've seen people show you how you're supposed to live as a result of how they believe he lived. And I'll tell you about the images of Jesus that I saw growing up. And the reason I'm giggling is because I think that they're highly inaccurate. So, I saw a Jesus who, he's very meek, he's very mild, he's very tender. He has like a stuffed lamb that he totes around. He likes hugging kids, and he's very nice to people. He sheds tears, he cries, you know, he exhibits sorrow and care. Again, he's like super meek, super mild. And then the kicker is, he reminds me of pictures I've seen of my parents during that, you know, that cool era of the 60s and the 70s. Like, he's a middle-aged white guy. He's got a beard and long hair. Yeah, you're allowed to laugh. You are allowed to laugh. And these are things, like, I saw them in, like, Bible study or Sunday school lessons, the Sundays that I was allowed to be there. You know, I saw pictures of stained glass windows in the Catholic Church that depicted renderings of Jesus. And he always seemed to be, like, this really nice guy, this guy that, you know, he'd give you a hug when you needed it. Super meek, super mild. But what I noticed about all of those images after having read the Bible, studied Jesus' biographies, which are the Gospels, what I noticed about absolutely every one of the images that we've created about Jesus is they conceal far more than they reveal. And because of this, I had some real personal notions, some ideas, some thoughts that I had developed about Jesus. I mean, one of those thoughts was, I mean, I knew, like, I was running with some crazies as a youngster. So the Jesus that I met that liked stuffed animals was the Jesus that was going to get clowned in my neighborhood, was the Jesus that wasn't tough enough to play street basketball with those people. He was a Jesus that just wouldn't have made it. He wouldn't have made it where I lived. He wouldn't have made it in the school that I went to. He was not tough enough. And some of us, you know, we follow a Jesus who's hyper-focused on what we're passionate about. And maybe that's a political bent, or maybe it's like a social bent. Or maybe it's an idea that you believe you're supposed to be passionate about. Some of us, we're following a Jesus who's more like a 911 dispatcher than he is a God who's in the trenches of life with you. He's someone that you dial into when you're experiencing personal turmoil in your life. But he's a God, he's like, where is he? Where is he when the day-to-day hits? He's a Jesus who's not there. Some of us are following a Jesus that he'd never call us to interact with those people because those people are too dirty. Those people use the wrong language. Those people are too sinful. He'd never call me to go there and say that to those people. He's a Jesus that he upholds our values, but he winks when I'm sleeping with my girlfriend. Or he winks when I'm engaged in some sinful behavior. He's a Jesus who's given us a checklist of things to do in order to earn his acceptance. For some of us, that's the Jesus that we follow. And here's one that really, like, rocked my world as I was studying this particular text. And this is a portrayal of Jesus that I will tag this to myself because this is personally how I feel I've depicted Jesus. And it's this one. It's the Jesus who I applauded when he came after me, his enemy. The Bible says that I was hostile in thought and deed towards a righteous and holy God. I applauded, I clapped, I cheered when he came and rescued me, his enemy. But I have a hard time imagining that God would rescue my enemies. I have a real hard time imagining a God that's going to go behind enemy lines and rescue the people, the political systems, the organizations that I perceive are my enemies. Because here's what I think about my enemies in and of myself. And I think Jesus, and this is what I portray on Jesus. He knows that my enemies, they deserve justice, not rescue. They deserve retaliation, not reconciliation. That's the idea of Jesus that I've invented. And what I fail to realize is when we see a picture of God going behind enemy lines, it's not that, like, we were trapped by the enemy and we weren't the enemy and he was coming to get us out. We were the enemy. When he went behind enemy lines, it's because I was part of the enemy line. And he didn't leave me there. He brought me out of that. We weren't captured by the enemy. We were the enemy. And so for me, if I make this really, really personal, the turmoil of my life, demanded something more than a meek and mild Jesus. The meek and mild Jesus was not going to take the shame and the guilt and the pain and the anguish that I was experiencing as a result of aborting a child. The meek and mild Jesus wasn't going to do that. I needed him to be tough enough to knock me down and tell me first and foremost that that was wrong. And I needed him to be tender enough to say, guess what? It's wrong, but it's going to be okay. That's the Jesus that I needed. I needed a Jesus that wasn't just meek and mild. I needed a Jesus that was hard as nails. I needed the Damascus Road Jesus that was going to knock me off my horse and pick me back up again. That's the Jesus that I needed. I needed a Jesus tough enough to thwart the addiction to drugs, the pursuit of using people and things to my personal benefit. That's the Jesus that I needed. I needed Jesus to paralyze me in my tracks, to put me at a dead stop, a dead halt, and to redirect absolutely every aspect of who I am. I needed a Jesus that was tough enough to tell me that I was dead and gracious enough to bring me back to life again. That's the Jesus that I needed. I needed a Jesus that was bold enough to go behind enemy lines and see that I was his enemy. And I needed him to look me in the eye and say, it's going to be okay. I'm taking you to the other side. I needed a Jesus that was powerful enough not just to rescue me from sin, but to sustain me as I continuously wrestle and combat the day-to-day war against the sin that plagues my life. And the thing is, like, my imagination wasn't enough. I never would have come up with the picture of Jesus that we see in these five verses. The Colossian church never, in and of themselves, would have come up with this picture of Jesus. Because what Paul is introducing is a God that cannot be conquered. He's introducing a God who sustains everything, a God who rescues and defends what he loves, a God who loves his enemies. The image of Jesus that we see Paul outlining is the image of God that people have always craved. Our challenge has always been that we lack the wisdom because we lack the wisdom in coming up with this image. We're never going to create a God that's as loving, as caring, as wise, as gracious, as just, as powerful as the God that we see in Jesus. And the God that we see in Jesus is one who's capable of looking at absolutely every layer of our dysfunction. Our relational dysfunction, our psychological dysfunction, our emotional dysfunction. You name it, he's capable of seeing absolutely every layer of it and reordering it. And in verse 20, here's what Paul goes on to say. He says that through Jesus, God is reconciling everything to himself by making peace through the blood of his cross, whether things on earth or things in heaven. It's a big deal. And what Paul is doing here is he's doing a bit of a course change for us because he's turning our direction, our focus, from a God who created everything to now a God who's going to rescue and restore the things that he created. It's through Jesus' sinless life. This is what Paul is thinking of when he writes this letter. It's Jesus' sinless life, his atoning death, his glorious resurrection that is going to put in motion a plan to reorder all things. It's gonna validate the fact that God is who he said he is and can do absolutely everything that he said he can do. And ultimately, Paul is saying Jesus is the God who's always existed. He's the God who has the power to create, to sustain, to rescue, to restore. He has the power to protect, to defend that which he loves. He has the power to win back a people who are trapped in slavery to sin. That is the Jesus that Paul is telling us about. He's a Jesus who's capable of looking at our dysfunction, addressing our biggest fears, taking our hopes and our aspirations and reorienting them to him and him alone. That's the Jesus that Paul is talking about. And ultimately, he's a Jesus who's able to give us a righteous standing before a righteous and holy God. And the next big idea that I believe Paul is trying to convince us of is simply this, that in Jesus, God sees an absolutely perfect image of us. And to illustrate this, I'm going to walk you through what we're calling it's an Old Testament story. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, the book is called Exodus. If you're not familiar with the book, I'd encourage you spend some time there. There's some big things that happen. There's a lot to learn with regards to who God is and what God does through that book as he interacts with the people that that are in that book. But to get to it, what we see in the Exodus story is we see God's people. They're called the Israelites. They're Israel. They've been taken captive in a place called Egypt. They're slaves. So in other words, they're being slave driven. They're the victims of what we could just call slavery. They're the victims of an oppressive political regime. As a result of that, they're time and time again subjected to forced labor, harsh working conditions. And what that does to a person, coercion, I mean, you name it. They're subject to all that. And what that does to a person is it creates deep psychological, emotional, spiritual, and even physical scars that you don't just overcome. You don't just heal from. And the Exodus account shows us a God who responds to a people who are clamoring for help, for a people who need to be freed from the slave driver. We see God inflict pain, natural disaster, physical loss, economic collapse on Egypt. Throughout the story of Israel's Exodus, we see a God who is sufficient enough to sustain his people regardless of the circumstance. We see a God who's powerful enough to overcome the worst of oppressors. We see a God who's dedicated enough to offer us a promise of ultimate freedom, a promise of a land that we can call home, that's free from oppression, it's free from slavery, it's free from emotional turmoil. We see a God who's powerful enough to conquer our worst enemy and secure freedom. We also see a people who are deeply wounded. They're deeply scarred. And so throughout this narrative, we see them wrestling with what they believe. They're wrestling with their ideas about God. They're wrestling with who is God? Can we really trust him? Can he do what he said he's going to do? And so time and time again, they default in their thinking. They go to their default mechanism, which is completely jaded. It's scarred. It's marred. It's warped. It's distorted. And they come up with ideas about God. And they apply those ideas to God as they interact with him. And one of the things that God does to try to circumvent that is he gives his law. He spells out 10 commandments, and then he gives out some other statutes in addition to that. And when he's doing this and giving his law, what God is saying is, I am for you, I'm not against you, because God's law always has our best interests in mind. And what God is giving these people is a way to recalibrate the way that they think, the way that they live, the way that they do life. Because this is a best case scenario for human beings. God's law, God's way, what God is going to ask you to do, if you're kind of thinking through this and you want a working definition of this, God is never going to tell you to do something that's not ultimately for your own benefit or your own good. Regardless of how hard it feels or how hard it seems or how much pain it may cause momentarily, he's never going to have you do something that you're going to regret. And the reason why you won't regret it is when you follow God, it's always worth it. Whatever you're going to be called to walk away from to follow Jesus is going to be worth it. The best is yet to come in that regard. So we read about a God who is openly addressing a people who's scarred and marred by social injustice, by racism, by abuse. We see a God that is interacting with his people, and we see a people who time and time again forget who God is and what God's doing. And it becomes abundantly clear that the circumstantial change, the fact that they're not in Egypt anymore, that wasn't the problem. The economic change, the fact that God's ultimately just providing for them time and time again. And I think the Bible even talks about the fact that, like, their sandals didn't wear out. Their clothes didn't get holes in them. They were well provided for, well cared for. They've seen miracles. The problem was not their circumstance. What we see at work in these people is the fact that ultimately they were enslaved to an idea about God. And ultimately, if you're enslaved to an idea about God, you're enslaved to sin. And that is something that's far more powerful than Egypt's Pharaoh or any of the oppressors that we're going to face in our lives. The God that they imagined, unfortunately, wasn't even interested in deep life change. The God that they imagined was just going to get them out of there and then send them on their way. Everything was going to be kosher after that. That's what it was going to be. But the God that they were encountering was a God that was saying, that is not a best case scenario for you. You need deep life change. You're not going to survive otherwise. What we learn ultimately is that Israel, despite their task list, despite their understanding of the law, they couldn't break their own chains. And all through the Exodus account, Israel saw glimpses of God, but what they never saw was a clear image of him. They heard his voice. They saw him in the pillar of cloud during the day. They saw him in the pillar of fire during the night. They saw God's handwriting on the stone tablets. They helped erect the tabernacle where they worshiped God. But all the while, they lacked the understanding of who God really was. Because here's what we do. We don't naturally imagine a God who loves his enemies. We don't naturally imagine a God who's willing to take on the oppressor. We don't naturally imagine a God that wants to reconcile us to him. Because we don't naturally imagine ourselves as enemies of God. What I'm about to say next, I think, is huge for everybody that's ever lived and everybody who ever will live, and it's this. Because of our sin, we are absolutely incapable of creating an accurate image of God. And here's what God does. He doesn't say, sorry to those people. They can't come up with it on their own. They're not smart enough. They're not wise enough. So God provides the image in Jesus. He literally provides the image that we've all craved, that we've all longed for, that our lives demand. He provides it in Jesus. He gives us a perfect, vivid, working image of who he is. And it's not an abstraction. It's not a symbol that points to a God. It's an accurate rendering of who God is. The Exodus of Israel, ultimately, it points to Jesus, the Jesus who is our Exodus. The Jesus who rescues us from the slave driver of sin. It's the Jesus who doesn't just point to freedom, it's the Jesus who is our freedom. It's not the Jesus who just sustains us, it's the Jesus who is our sustenance. He doesn't just point to a promised land, he is our promised land. He's not telling us that freedom is secured. He himself is our freedom. Because here's the thing when it comes to Jesus. Only Jesus. Jesus is the only one capable of purchasing slaves and making them heirs to his kingdom. Only Jesus is capable of rescuing sinners and making them saints. There is no one outside of Jesus that is capable of doing that. Listen to what Paul says to the Galatian church. He says, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, an heir through God. Jesus is not just going through great lengths to break the chains of slavery to sin. Jesus is enduring the greatest pain, the greatest deal of anguish, the greatest deal of loss to secure freedom from slavery forever, for now and for later. This is the picture that I need you to see when it comes to Jesus. It's you. You're naked. You're chained to the auction block of slavery. You're vulnerable, you're weak, you've been devalued. Nobody wants you. There is a price put on you. Someone is trying to sell you. And Jesus doesn't just come in and buy you at the going rate. The going rate had totally devalued you. Jesus comes and he offers the greatest thing that he could possibly offer. He chains himself to the block so that you don't have to be chained to the block. He buys you out of slavery with his life. He takes the shackles off of you and he puts them on himself. The God of the universe bought you. Like, do we get it? The God of the universe was willing to purchase us at all costs. And he bought us out of slavery and into freedom. And it's not so you can just pitter-patter back to the life that you were living. So that you can crawl back to the who you were and be where you were. But it's so that you can experience the life you've never dreamed of. Because here's the thing, the image of self that you have, it's marred. It's not as beautiful as the image of you that Jesus has. The same way that we mar the image of God by coming up with ideas, we mar the image of self by coming up with ideas. And Jesus is putting to rest our dysfunctional views of God, our dysfunctional views of self. And he's doing it by paying a penalty that we couldn't pay. And here's what verse 21 says in the Colossians text. We're in chapter 1. It says, "Once you were alienated and hostile in your minds because of your evil actions, but now he has reconciled you by his physical body through his death to present you holy, faultless, and blameless before him." Do you hear what Paul is saying? Can you hear what he's saying? He's saying that we hated God, but God did not hate us back. We were starkly opposed to God, but God did not oppose us in return. We were enemies of God, but God did not destroy us. Do we hear what Paul is saying? He saw us hostile in the way that we think, hostile in the way that we live. And he didn't just leave us there. He came and got us. He revealed himself to us. He died for us. He showed us who he really was and how deep his love really went. The God we meet in Jesus, he's not a God that just goes around executing justice and eradicating his enemies from the face of the earth. He's a God who endured death ultimately to rescue his enemies. He's a God who's capable of forgiving his enemies, making them completely blameless, faultless, and holy in his sight. Because of Jesus, we're capable of seeing God for who he is, but I think more importantly to the practicality of our day-to-day lives, because of Jesus, God can see us as we are incapable of seeing ourselves. He can see us as blameless and faultless. He doesn't see you as you are. You're not a sum of your mistakes or even a sum of your perceived success. God isn't measuring you by way of whether or not you're going to overcome that addiction today, tomorrow, or 10 years from now. God's not looking at you through the lens of sin anymore. He's looking at you through the lens of Jesus. His view of you is not based on your current struggle and whether or not you're going to get to the other side. The relationship that you've ruined. The habitual pattern, which is more like a train wreck than a pattern in your life. God is not basing his view of you on your inability to see him for who he is. He's basing his view of you on Jesus' finished work. Your image in sight of God is based on the sum of Jesus' work, the sum of Jesus' perfect life, his innocent death, his glorious resurrection. Jesus sees you as faultless, as blameless, as holy. So here's what this means. In Jesus, you have absolutely nothing to prove. There's not a list of things that you have to accomplish to earn what Jesus has freely given you. There's no punch list. We've all learned that we fail when it comes to the punch list. That's why Jesus came. He completed the punch list for us. In Jesus, you have the freedom to fail, but you also have the freedom to succeed. You have the freedom to take risk. You have the freedom to live a life worth living without having to try to manipulate your image of God to make yourself feel good about the way that you're living. And this is all because Jesus has put to rest our dysfunctional image of God, and he's equally put to rest our dysfunctional image of ourselves. So you can think of like the best version of yourself that you can come up with. I dare you to try to do that. What God sees when he sees you blows that out of the water a gajillionfold, if that's even a number. Like, it turns our thoughts about us and about him on their head. And what Jesus is doing ultimately is he's reorienting the way that we think about God, the way that we think about ourselves, and that should translate to the way that we think about the people in our lives. No longer are we allowed to just arbitrarily place value on things. We're called to value what God values, to pursue what God would have us pursue, to engage in the things that God would have us engage in. And we can do it without the risk of failure. So to summarize this and just kind of put a nice little bow on it at the end, if you're here today and you're walking through a story, it's your story. God's given you breath. He's given you life. He's given you today. If you're walking that story out and you've yet to reconcile your life with God, you're not going to regret doing it today. You're not going to regret doing an about face and running headlong from what you're in pursuit of and running towards the arms of a Jesus who's tough enough to confront your worst enemy, your worst fear. And he's tender enough to tell you that everything that you've broken and destroyed and maimed is going to be okay. He's capable of doing that. And if you're here today and you haven't reconciled your life with a God who loves you, then I'd encourage you, stick around when I close. There are people here that would love to talk that out with you. You're not going to regret it. So, church, just know this, that when we see Jesus, when we read his biographies, when we see the way that he valued people, when we see the way that he loved us in dying for us while we were yet sinners, know that what you're seeing is a perfect image of the God who came to rescue and restore you. And know that as a result of what Jesus has completely finished, know that when God sees you through the lens of Jesus, he sees a perfect image of you. That's all I have for you this morning.